Good afternoon. I will now call this meeting of the Senate Transportation Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:34 p.m. on Tuesday, February 21st, 2023. Let the record also reflect we have a quorum to conduct business. Present today is Vice Chair Jesse Keel, or Vice Chair Wilson, Senator Jesse Keel, Senator Lukey Tobin, and myself, Chairman James Kaufman. Don't see any other legislators in the room. Our LIO moderator is Jake Wade, Johanna Crossett from Records, and my Transportation Committee aide, Emma Torkelson. Please silence your cell phones, and if you have any good phone puns later on, be sure and let me know. I didn't have one for today. Opening agenda. We have just one job today. On our agenda, we'll hear a presentation from the Department of Transportation on roads, highways, and bridges across Alaska. Invited testifiers presenting today from the Department of Transportation, both in person and on Teams, should we be able to surmount Teams connections and muting and all of that business. We have Catherine Keith, Deputy Commissioner, Joe Kemp, Acting Northern Region Director, Wolfgang Jung, Central Region Director, Lance Meerig, South Coast Region Director, and Leslie Dougherty, Bridge Design and Standards Group Chief. So I want to thank all for being available today. Presenters, so please approach, state your name and affiliation for the record, and let's begin.
For the record, Catherine Keith, a Deputy Commissioner, Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Leslie Dougherty, Chief Bridge Engineer from Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities.
Thanks for coming. Please proceed.
Well, thanks to Chair Kaufman for the excellent introductions of our staff. In addition to those in person present, including Leslie Dougherty and South Coast Region Director Lance Meerig, we also have our legislative liaison, Andy Mills. And online with us are Acting Northern Region Director Joe Kemp and Central Region Director Wolfgang Jung. Wanted to point out a couple of things in our recent org chart. The Commissioner Ryan Anderson, he oversees the three regions that are represented here today, Central Region and South Coast Region. He also oversees the two deputy commissioners, including Deputy John Binder and myself, Catherine Keith. And then between us, we divide up a number of divisions, including our international airports, our program development and planning, statewide design and engineering, and AMHS, and a number of other functions. And I'm happy to answer any other questions about this, but I could point out just a couple new additions to the programming of DOT, and that includes a focus on our iways, or in other words, big data and transportation. This is a program that we're very excited to be launching. iways, just for the public listening, really focuses on intelligent transportation solutions, or otherwise known as ITS, intelligent transportation systems. And we have a couple ITS plans throughout the state of Alaska, including for two key corridors, Glen Highway and the Seward Highway. And there's a lot of cases where DOT utilizes ITS and the public may not realize it, including our 511, our traveler information systems, which provides real-time travel data. Our ferry system uses GIS tracking. And as we move forward with our NEVI program, which is an electric vehicle implementation program, we're also going to rely heavily on data, both for the power quality going to charging stations and the information that we need to be reporting back to federal highways. So this is something that its inclusion in the commissioner's office is representative of just the critical nature of how we want to integrate these systems moving forward.
Thank you.
So the committee had asked a couple questions about how DOT across our state, a very large state, ends up sharing resources and the way that this works functionally. So you could see that this is represented in a matrix setting where we have regions broken out geographically, which describes how our project delivery programs are laid out, but yet we have a number of functional resources such as procurement, communications, human resources, recruitment, planning, and these resources are shared throughout the regions. What we're working on at the commissioner's office is developing project teams that cross regional boundaries, because what we're understanding is there could be expertise in northern region that's really needed in South Coast and vice versa. So we have a number of projects that we would consider high risk projects that benefit from having multiple people from across the state, regardless of the organizational boundaries that they currently work within. And so these you can see represented below in the graphics, but we're calling them our Transportation X projects. And I'm going to speak a little bit more about that as we go through the presentation. This can be done both formally and informally with how we work with our staff across regional boundaries. Sometimes we are able to share resources pretty fluidly, and other times we do make it a formal task assignment, so to speak, when one employee is working for a different supervisor in a different region, so it helps to establish clear boundaries. Sharing of resources statewide is something that we're working on to do more and more as resources are constrained or our workforce is depleted in certain key areas, and we are constantly finding new strategies to do this that both employees and our supervisors can work with.
Deputy Commissioner, so this model that you're showing, is it fully implemented in transition, somewhat aspirational, but we're moving there?
Yeah, thank you for the question, Senator Kaufman. Catherine Keith for the record. Now, this is being fully implemented, and the rows that you see on the left-hand side, such as procurement and communications, these have formally moved to a statewide model where they are teaming and providing resources from one region to the next as the demand surges. Similarly with planning, these are we now have statewide teams that are less focused on the boundaries in which they work, but have a more modal approach. There are other areas that are more of a hybrid approach to this. Examples could be within our construction engineers, for example. Those are experts that are typically specialized in certain areas, and so those tend to be shared less from one region to the next, but it is still happening. Mm-hmm. Another question from the committee that we really appreciated was on earned value management, and for the public listening, earned value management is a way, it's a project management technique where you can be reporting out on key metrics of project performance against a baseline that's been established at the beginning of a project. These include things like scope, schedule, and budget. Within our current project management systems at the department, we don't have the ability to do this automatically, so we have numerous ways to pull status reports in our system that's called MRS, but it doesn't migrate directly into a performance dashboard where you could see the metrics that we would want to see, such as earn value or the performance indexes or schedule variance. What we are seeing is across the agency, we have project managers that are doing this on their own. And that's an example of what you can see on the slide before you is using Microsoft Power BI, where they're manually entering in information so they can have a dashboard that's available, which shows you some of the metrics that you'd see typical of an earned value management approach. But it's not done automatically. And so one of the change initiatives we've been working on over the past months is providing some best practices for project management, including a center of excellence, a project management office. And as this moves forward, having common metrics like this is something that we're looking forward to doing automatically, so it's not so work intensive and independent of one project manager skills to the next. Now, across the department, another area of interest is how we're delivering our projects, the project management methods itself, and the way in which we work to deliver projects. And as an organization, and transportation in general, typically has been a very waterfall-like approach to managing projects. And this is done intentionally because a lot of our funding is based on these stage gates. So we have authorities to proceed after we achieve a certain point in a project development. Funding is released and we move on to the next. And that is in alignment with a very waterfall approach. And in a lot of cases, this linear approach to project delivery works well. However, as we are becoming more resource constrained and there's changing external factors in the world around us, we have been looking towards adopting a more agile framework to project management and project delivery. Project management typically follows these initiating, planning, executing, monitoring, and closing phases. But within that, we do have a lot of flexibility to be agile and have iterative processes that allow us to engage with community in new ways and to partner with our federal agencies and industry to be able to provide input on a project as we go, so we're constantly creating value along the way. And this is something that our commissioner was interested in pursuing more, and we submitted a research project to the Transportation Research Board, and we requested $75,000 but actually got $350,000, so that nationally we're going to have a lot of support to look at how we can do this for transportation effectively and then develop some best practices tools, which we really look forward to having.
Mm-hmm. Question. Have you identified states that you think are good fits that are maybe doing a better job in certain areas, also known as benchmarking?
Yeah. Chair Kaufman, for the record, Catherine Keith, yes, we have been looking at other state DOTs. AASHTO has a number of good systems in place. A couple of states I could call out specifically, the Texas DOT and Oregon DOT have great online platforms for project management. They provide tools, videos for project managers, and they have pathways for this. There's not a lot of background in agile deployment within transportation. Vertical infrastructure sometimes has more of an approach to lean construction than other states. So it does exist out there, and we're looking forward through this project to help develop further partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, and thank you, Deputy Commissioner. I have a quick question because I noticed it on the previous slides, and I'm noticing it here again. With regards to the functional resources and diffusing planning across all the regions, is this no longer that there's going to be regional planning offices, or is it all now under one house?
Yeah, through the Chair, Senator Tobin. Regarding our program development and planning, we are looking forward to having just a statewide approach. We still currently have local offices so that communities right now know who they can talk to, and that is something that's in a bit of transition, but we are having a statewide, you know, more horizontal approach to the providing resources to communities for planning.
And is that, you had mentioned on this slide that you're becoming more resource constrained. Is that a aspect of the resource becoming limited, or are you having to deploy resources in a more broader sense?
Yeah, through the Chair, Senator Tobin, I would say the answer is yes, we are resource constrained. That being said, we also want to apply people's skills to the need, and sometimes those skill sets aren't necessarily within a regional boundary, and so when we can apply someone that may have expertise in transit systems or expertise in rural port infrastructure, it helps to be able to move them around as needed while we gain expertise and share that expertise.
Mm-hmm. If I could, when I think of lean management operations, it's respecting the fact that we're always resource constrained. I've never been unrestrained in that respect. So I think it's just recognizing and have a program to recognize natural constraints and trying to optimize within them. Senator Wilson, I think maybe you're next, and Senator Keel.
Thank you. Deputy, just a quick question on the agile on number 5. Let's release. All the other ones seem pretty self-explanatory.
Yeah, through the Chair, Senator Wilson. Yeah, agile processes typically follow a pretty standard cyclical approach. And so in this case, when we refer to release, that's where we're having a final product that the customer could approve. So it could be developing a document, say it's a preliminary engineering study. The release point would be where we can provide that back to the community, even if it's in draft phase or to a federal agency, they can provide their input on it. And then as it moves forward through the next cycle of development, whatever input they had can get immediately integrated. And that's a different strategy than the more linear waterfall approach where we would approach something at like 90% and then provide it back for the, you know, that release phase.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Deputy Commissioner, thanks for this. I have to confess that this is not my bailiwick. This is not where I have much expertise. I showed this to somebody who said, this looks like a recipe for going off before you've got your ducks in a row and getting a lot of change orders. What's he missing? What don't I understand? Because there's a lot of terms here that I don't know what they mean.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's a fantastic question. For the record, Catherine Keith, we actually see it a little bit differently in that it's a way to mitigate risk earlier on because we're getting a very clear sense of scope. We're evaluating options thoroughly before we launch into another phase. Oftentimes when we get excited towards a specific project or design, we can go very far down one path without getting all of the external engagement that we need. So this cyclical approach, it's not, we're still following the stage gates as required by an agency such as Federal Highways, but yet we're getting input constantly so that ideally we're providing a project which everyone has had buy-in all along the way and the opportunity to provide input so that the change orders are actually less.
Interesting. Dr. Keel, if I may offer, so in lean management processes, one of the things to avoid is overworking something at the point that it's at, because you may not know what you need to know in order to do to go beyond that. So it's really to judge the correct state of completion of whatever the task is at that point before you proceed to the next. Otherwise, you may be expending time and effort on something that's not ready for prime time. You know, you may overwork it, in other words, in simple terms. So that's what processes like this are guarding against, is waste in that area where you may overdevelop a direction that turns out not to be the way you're going to go. And then all of that time and effort and money is wasted. So, but it has to be done properly to avoid what you're saying, where you blow through something and you're out there, and next thing you know, you're getting hit with change orders. Okay, let's proceed.
For the record, Catherine Keith. With project delivery in general, one of the ways that we're prioritizing engagement is through formal partnerships with other state agencies, with municipalities, tribal governments, and our private partners. And so we've been engaging very regularly with AGC, which is the Alaska General Contractors, Associated General Contractors of Alaska, and also ACEC, the American Council of Engineering Companies. We are working with AEA, for example, on the Alaska Energy Authority on our NEVI plan, which is a rollout of our electric vehicle program. And we also are really grateful for the efforts of AML, Alaska Municipal League, who's been helping us with all of our grants, discretionary grant strategy. And we've created a clearinghouse called the Hub, which is federalfunding.org, where you can go to and find information about the discretionary grant opportunities. So there is a lot of lifting to be done with transportation right now because of our federal funding opportunities, and the way forward is through partnerships. When our regional directors come online, I know they'll have some things to say about how they specifically have been partnering with communities and other local governments. Mm-hmm.
I see here something that obviously has piqued my interest, which is more local planning. Can you expound on this a little bit more?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Tobin, For the record, Catherine Creeth, that yes, we want to be planning, focusing on community-driven planning. And that is a different framework than a more top-down approach where DOT, as an agency, we have our area plans, which work well with local community plans, but we want to support communities in their planning efforts. And one tool that we're using to do this is the development of the Rural Planning Organizations. Their RPOs is the acronym. These are very similar to an MPO, in which a regional area, a municipality, gets to develop their list of projects that they prioritize. A rural planning organization gets to do the same thing, and they'll look throughout their region. They're given planning money from the state, and then they create their own, their TIP, or their transportation improvement program. So they get to have a prioritized list of projects, which then go into our statewide transportation improvement program. So in that way, we're trying to empower the communities to look at their needs and bring those needs to us versus us telling them what we think that their needs are.
Obviously, this piques my interest, as my master's degree is in asset-based community development, which is about being community-driven and community-led. But I'm curious, when you mentioned the planning money, is this a single pot that you then distribute to more entities, or is it already parceled out that the municipality of Anchorage gets a pot, Fairbanks gets a pot, Juneau gets a pot, and then the regional organizations have a different funding source? Or how does that work?
Yeah, through the chair to Senator Tobin, the rural planning organizations are set a little differently, and we've gone back and forth between regional planning organizations and rural, so excuse me for going back and forth, but those amounts we just have formal MOAs with whoever the sponsoring agents is of the RPO. And while at the municipal level, those are set amounts that have been kind of predetermined from one year to the next, with the RPOs, it's still a relatively new structure. There's only two that we have formally signed, and those will be just renewed on an annual basis, I believe.
Thank you. Just out of curiosity, is it one pot of money or is it multiple pots of money?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, our program development and planning has the resources available, like a budget that they use for planning throughout the state, and they have a plan that they get pre-approved with federal highways every year. It's their work plan, and in their work plan, they'll have funding in that allocated towards the rural planning organizations. And so I think what I'm hearing you say is that there is one pot of money that they're using through federal highways, and we're providing that to the communities. And I can provide more information, or ask Mr. Marks, our program development division director.
I'm just curious to know if we've seen funding shift from metropolitan areas to rural areas because of this. So that's what I'm curious to know.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Tobin, no, it doesn't take away from the municipal planning organizations. It's additive.
Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Okay, and for the record, Catherine Keith, this is the last high-level slide before we get to the actual projects, which is, I know, what everyone is excited to be hearing about most. Just wanted to provide a slide. This is actually from the Oregon Department of Transportation. When we talk about how other states are viewing their project life cycles, Commissioner Anderson looks at this and he wants us to see it as a racetrack, not just a pathway or a roadmap, because we have to hurry up and get a lot of work done. So through federal highways, I mentioned we do have a number of stage gates to get a project from beginning, from cradle to grave. And some of those stage gates will include preliminary engineering. It could be a planning and environmental linkage study that gets completed. We have our PSNE, which is our final design phase. We also have to secure right of way. These things happen before we get to construction. And happy to answer any more questions about the process, but we can speak to some of these processes through example by talking about our bridge program.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Deputy Commissioner, in the lower right of here, I see Oregon has retained some regional planning. There's a regional phase gate, stage gate, phase gate. And I guess it's interesting to me. I have some concern about the conversation earlier about going to one statewide planning approach. We don't have much permafrost here in Southeast, and the mountains out in the YK Delta are not so steep. Can you talk to us about why we think it's a responsible approach to get away from regional planning?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Keel. Yeah, thank you for the question. I do like about this slide that they have a number of standard project methodologies, including this project initiation and project charter. These are things that we have been taking on. And to answer your question about the regional applicability to that, is that does going to a statewide resourcing model allows us to leverage our resources where they're needed at the time, but it doesn't remove expertise that individual planners have where it comes to modes or geography, but it allows them to address other areas of need as well, other than just what their workload may be within a region. What we're seeing is the work needs ebb and flow from one region to the next, and we want to make sure that we can just provide equal levels of service, kind of regardless of where a community is geographically. So I would say that we're not losing out on the expertise that certain planners would have in a certain region, but just making it so that there's greater greater flexibility when using resources.
Follow-up. Thank you. My understanding of our planning and design staffing situation is such that we're probably not able to meet the baseline need at ebb of every region, and we contract for all the flow. Doesn't that seem a better way to ensure that we've retained regional expertise rather than hoping eventually when we get to one pool, somebody somewhere has got the regional know-how, as long as we've still got them, maybe?
Yeah, through the chair to Senator Keel. We have a number of planning positions that are vacant right now. And so when a community looks at our regional map and they look at their region and they see that their planner position is vacant, you know, they're unsure where should they go to talk to for information about their projects. So we still have a regional approach in trying to match up available planners with communities in need. But we do want to have the flexibility of being able to resource our teams where needed at the time. So, and also partnering with our consultants and getting the support to backfill as needed, but that still requires, you know, a pretty substantial amount of staff support to keep all of this moving. Trying to think of a couple examples to illustrate the point. We have a Northern Region engineer that's living here in Juneau and has been working actively on a number of projects, but still has that Northern Region expertise. So what we're finding as a state is just the flexibility in work with hybrid working arrangements, regardless of where they're at, still allows people to be put to projects where they're most needed, regardless of who they're reporting to at the time. Mm-hmm. So with that, I'd like to introduce Leslie Doherty to speak to our Bridge program.
For the record, Leslie Doherty, Chair Kaufman and committee, thank you for your interest in Bridges. I'm just going to give you an overview of what's going on right now in our Bridge world. So the state has 1,055 state and locally owned bridges. There are further about 600 federal bridges. The state does not have anything to do with the federal bridges in Alaska. As you can see, DOT owns about 850 bridges, and then further different kinds of culverts are considered bridges by federal definition. Transfer bridges are also considered part of the national highway system, and we help cities and boroughs with about 170 of their bridges. And this is mostly inspection unless they ask for design assistance.
Context, please, the term transfer bridges?
Oh, those would be the bridges at ferry terminals that get cars onto the boats, onto the ferries.
Mm-hmm. Question, Senator Tobin?
I apologize, this is a very dumb question. Who manages the federal bridges?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, that's a good question, actually. There are many federal agencies in Alaska that manage those bridges. The majority, I think, are U.S. Forest Service, but BIA, BLM, Army Corps, and the military all own bridges in Alaska. And there could be some others I'm not aware of.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. We have another question from Senator Q.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to make sure I understand. The first, make sure I understand that that second bullet, when a culvert hits 20 feet, it's a bridge. Is that how I'm to understand that?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. And then I'm speculating wildly. Which three bridges are owned, or which other state agencies own three bridges?
Through the chair again, I believe those are DNR bridges,
nope.
Department of National Resources. They own some bridges in hunting areas and parks.
All right, let's proceed.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so to hit some more on, to emphasize more of the inspection aspect of what we do, every bridge in the United States that's open to the public has to be inspected at a minimum of every 24 months. If the bridge is in a poor condition, it might have to be inspected more frequently. So we as DOT inspect about 500 bridges every summer. We take that information, we put it into a bridge management system, and then once a year, we send all that data to federal highways. We have been doing our inspection program since about the 1960s, 1960-62. So we led the nation. We did inspections, bridge inspections here in Alaska before it was federal law. We are then graded, or sort of, or assessed. Federal Highways assesses our program based on bridge metrics. And when it comes to planning, then, that data from our bridge inspections is taken, and it's we are required by federal law to have less than 10% of the bridges on the national highway system in poor condition. And the national highway system would be your main roads like the Glen Highway, the Seward Highway. And our target is greater than 40% of bridges in the state being in good condition. Okay, and so just some bridge terminology here. So in case I throw these words out, which we often use them quite often in bridge engineering, your bridge deck is what you drive on. It is supported by your beams or your girders, and that is called your superstructure. And the superstructure and the deck are supported by the substructure. So when we inspect bridges, we rate those three components, the deck, the superstructure, and the substructure. And the worst condition out of those three is what the bridge condition is considered to be. So when we say 10% less than 10% poor condition, that means any one of those deck super sub has to be less than 10%.
Thank you.
So how does that data look? These three graphs include our NHS bridges. So again, that's the main highway systems. Our non-NHS bridges would be those in communities or off the main roads, probably those in villages. Not in villages, but in small towns. And then off-system bridges would be the ones in villages. And as you can see, our trends are looking good. The condition of poor is decreasing with time. However, in this last year, we've had two large bridges go on into poor condition. So in 23, we'll probably have a bump up there in the trend. However, with all the bridges that we've planned for reconstruction and replacement, my sense is that around 2027 or so, we can have the percent poor down to 1% or less. That would be my goal. The problem is the bridges in good condition are not increasing as well. They're also decreasing. That percentage is getting smaller, and we want that percentage to get bigger. And the analogy I use is the oil change analogy. You can't have a car for 10 years and never change the oil. You can't have at least older bridges in the state. They need that oil change. They need the deck replacements or rehabilitations. They need some sort of maintenance. Our goal with new bridges is to design and construct bridges that don't need maintenance or as much maintenance, or at least not right away. Maybe they can wait 30 years before they get maintenance.
If we could pause for a moment. Yes. I believe we have a question. Senator Wilson.
Mr. Chair, some really a question, I guess, is more, can the committee get a copy of this broken down by where the actual bridge is by district. Because I don't know, you know, is 54%, is that 100 bridges, 500 bridges, mm-hmm. you know? So if we can just get that broken down to where these bridges are at, or just list them out mm-hmm. by community, and if they're in good poor condition, so we can mm-hmm. have a better understanding. Because some of these poor might be bridges that, you know, only see 50 cars a day versus, you know, one of those major bridges on the Glen, which see 45,000 cars mm-hmm. during a one-way traffic period. So just be helpful to get mm-hmm. a better understanding.
Through the chair, yes, of course, that's a great question. We can get that information for you. And you'll see on my last slide, there's a map, an interactive map that Federal Highways has, and I'll give you the link where you can find individual bridges within your district, and we can help you. It's not a very user-friendly website, but we could assist you or your staff to use that as well.
Please, if you would, send that through my office and we'll distribute. Mm-hmm. I have a question with regards to the kind of the bias towards maintenance. I've been studying other departments around the nation, and they've been starting to bias more towards preventative maintenance and trying. Everybody has a backlog, I guess, and so I think Colorado has recently really shifted towards like a maintenance first program, like maintain it, let's hold off on building new until we catch up on some of this. Is there such a bias right now is that what you're talking about as far as trying to improve the ratio of what's in great condition versus fair or poor?
Yeah, for the record, Leslie Darty, Chair Kaufman, that's a great point that you're making, and that's exactly what this TAMP data has shown us, that we need to focus more on maintenance and preventative maintenance as well. And so we are programming in the STIP money for bridge preventative maintenance to a larger extent than we've ever done before. And we've seen that work in other states.
Great, thank you.
Okay, one of the most significant projects going on right now in Alaska is the Sterling Highway 45 to 60 bypass. This is the Juneau Creek Bridge. It's a very large project, so that's why I'm focusing on this one over all of our other ones right now. It's most likely going to be the longest launched bridge. I have to emphasize launch bridge. It's not the longest bridge in the world. It's the longest bridge that, as you can see, is going to be pushed out over this canyon. It's taking a large team of people with expertise from across the country to design this project with our in-house staff. And we're anticipating that construction will start in 2024 and probably last 3 years.
Thank
you. So a topic that's been very relevant lately, in fact, we had a bridge get hit in Fairbanks on Sunday, has been bridge strikes. So I bring this up to let the committee know that we're doing what we can to look at this issue and try and find solutions. When I put on the slide 15 significant vehicle strikes, those are just ones that are reported to us. There could be others that we don't know about until we get to a bridge inspection and notice that a bridge has probably been hit and no one saw it or no one told us. So there are more bridges that have been struck than what are listed here, but these are the significant ones. And so we've been working with the Alaska Trucking Association, with our traffic and safety folks, to come up with low-cost or easy solutions to deal with this issue. Some other long-term ideas would be a higher minimum height, vertical clearance height requirement for design of bridges. You know, let's make the bridges taller so they don't get hit.
We have a question. Senator Wilson?
Yeah, who's responsible for sort of the repairs? I mean, is it the people that strike the bridges? I mean, obviously, if you catch them, if they stay around for that time period, but are they liable, or how is...
Sure. Through the chair, that's a great question, Vice Chair Wilson. So the department does try for cost recovery, so we would find out, if we can, who caused the strike and then get their insurance information. We've been pretty successful in getting cost recovery from most bridge strikes, the problem is if we don't see it happen, or we don't have a camera there or something like that.
Is this an insurable thing that we can, that Can we insure our bridges for bridge strikes?
Through the chair again, that's a question that came up through the Trucking Association as well. My understanding is that the state is self-insured, so we wouldn't do that, but it was a suggestion that another person has made, so it's worth talking about.
Any questions? I have one. Redesigning and elevating, that's obviously, expensive in the long term. Are there, electronic devices, transponders that could easily communicate, hey, you're rolling up on something mm-hmm. that is shorter than you are? Is there a solution like that?
Yeah, Chair Hoffman, that's a good question. I think some of the problem is that the trucks that cause a lot of these strikes are not the reputable companies who have plans and would follow the law anyway. So while it's definitely something we're looking at, sort of the Google car model, can we have a sensor on the pilot car that would beep for the truck driver before they get to the bridge? I think some of the problem is you wouldn't have trucks following the law who would want to implement that anyway.
I won't take you there.
No comment.
No comment. All right. Fair enough. Let's roll.
Okay.
Transportation.
All right. for the last slide here for me is I just wanted to make everyone aware that we have a bridge inventory. We list the bridges by number, by name, and by route, so you could easily look up the bridges in your community if you wanted. And then again, I mentioned this Federal Highways website with a map where you can find the historical inspection data of all the bridges in the state and look those up.
Great. Looks like we have a question from Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So obviously there's quite a bit of money coming in through IGEA, and one of it is in the Bridge Investment Program. I might be getting that title wrong, but I know that for bridges that we're looking at replacing or potentially that we want to move from poor into excellent, that there is resources also to build out some of the multimodal infrastructure in those systems. Mm-hmm. How is that on this inventory? How do we get more information about what are the potential opportunities in our community to add those assets or those utilities into the bridge replacements that might be happening? And how do we advocate for it?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin. I'm not the right person to ask about that. That's more of a planning question, but we can certainly help you find that information. What I can add is that the new funding that's come in has been great about not funneling funding to one type of bridge, like not just NHS. If there are off-system bridge funds, there are tribal bridge funds available, there are NHS funds available. So we're going to address all kinds of bridges where in the past maybe only one of those was emphasized.
Excellent. Well, if I can make a pitch for the Government Hill Bridge to have a better bike path, please record that wherever you need.
All right, let's proceed.
Hey, for the record, Catherine Keith, thank you, Leslie, very much. And I'd like to ask our Central Region Director, Wolfgang Young, if you're online.
Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you.
Thank
please.
You.
Audio good. Please put yourself on the record.
That's all right. Great. Thank you. For the record, my name is Wolfgang Young, Central Region Director. Pleased to speak to the committee today on transportation and construction in the Central Region area. First slide that you're looking at is the Anchorage Municipality 2023 area. We'll do Anchorage first, and then on to the Mattsu, and then to the Kenai, so one of these at a time. The first slide you hear, we've got 17 total projects shown on this particular slide, estimated construction value of over $216 million. We're going to talk about the Seward Highway project, O'Malley to Diamond, on a separate slide, so I'm going to skip over that for right now. But the two projects I wanted to highlight on this particular slide, the Dowling Road and Seward Highway Interchange Reconstruction Project. That's number 21 on your map. This project reconstructs the Dowling Road and Seward Highway interchanges. If you remember, this was our first original roundabout in the state, and the design standards back then were old, and they've been modified quite a bit since then. So this is our attempt to bring that up to modern-day standards. The Dowling East-West connection was closed during the summer of 2022, allowing the bridge and the roundabouts to be constructed in a single season. Work to reconstruct the ramps, milling, paving, finish striping, lighting, and signs will continue into 2023 with much less impact to the traveling public and very limited closures. Estimated cost of this project is around $43 million. The other project I wanted to highlight is the O'Malley Road Reconstruction Phase 2 from Livingston to Hillside Drive. Phase 1 of the project from Seward Highway to Livingston was completed in 2017. This is Phase 2 of the project, and it will reconstruct O'Malley from Livingston to Hillside, which will include safety and capacity improvements and pedestrian accommodations. Construction is expected to be completed summer of 2023. Total estimated project cost at around $41 million. Any questions on the Anchorage construction map?
Thank you. With respect to that last one, the O'Malley road construction and the pedestrian issues, there's been some real concerns about crosswalks to get to the elementary school. Just with, you know, having the better sidewalks and all that are great, but there's some concern about that. Has there been any developments on kind of future consideration of a crosswalk at the point where the kids might cross for school there?
Through the chair, Senator Kaufman, there has been some consideration. Scott Thomas, our regional traffic and safety engineer, has a study going on that right now, and we will get the status of that study to you, Senator, and provide that information for you.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Looks like we have a question.
Thank you. In terms of crosswalks, could his community just go ahead and design a crosswalk if DOT gives them the standards of the paint, the signage, similar to a situation that happened in Big Lake?
I, again, will have to ask our traffic and safety engineer. We've had communities implement improvement actions on state routes, but we certainly want to make sure it's coordinated and that it's safe and complies with all the standards before we would move forward on that. So that you're right, Senator Wilson. Apologies through the chair, Senator Wilson. You are correct. We did implement that with the Big Lake community, and that was a success. But it was certainly a coordinated one. So hope that answers your question, Senator.
Thank you. It looks like we have another question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not specific to that project, but right in the neighborhood. If memory serves, a few years back, DOT got a grant or chased some money to try and attack some of the frost heaving problems on, I think it was on Birch. And the project has worked phenomenally well. That road hasn't been touched in probably a decade, and there are no significant frost heaves. Is that an element that's the department has incorporated into other designs in the area?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, yes, we've taken those applications and applied it to other road structural sections when they have those same circumstances present. That is correct, Senator Keel.
Great to hear. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. No other questions. We'll proceed.
Great. Next slide. This slide, wanted to talk about. This is kind of our highlight project in the area. We're hoping to bid this out this coming year. So this is the Seward Highway O'Malley to Diamond project. This project reconstructs the Seward Highway between O'Malley Road and Diamond Boulevard, which will include new north and southbound lanes, auxiliary lanes, new interchange connections, connecting 92nd Avenue to Academy Drive, a diverging Diamond interchange at O'Malley, improvements to the existing interchange at Diamond, construction and reconstruction of frontage roads, pathways, sidewalk improvements throughout the area, noise walls, and drainage improvements. Total cost of the project is going to be around $113 million. And if we could, I'd like to forward to the next slide and talk about the risks and challenges and opportunities and solutions. Was there a quick question?
Before we do, I think we have a couple questions bubbling up. So, yeah. Senator Tobin.
Well, thank you, Wolfgang. And you know that you're going to get a lot of questions on this one. This is a hot topic that's happening in the Anchorage community right this moment. I know that there is a resolution being introduced tonight by my assembly member regarding this particular project, mostly focused on the Scooter Academy. And I am just curious, because we have been receiving quite a bit of public testimony. I know several community councils have come out with resolutions against the Scooter Academy roundabout interchange. I'm going to ask on the record, because I am curious about what can we do, or what are the potential if we take a more aggressive approach here from a state perspective on potentially trying to to defund this project, or if we potentially talk about other avenues or other things that might be implemented to stop something that much of the community is really adamantly opposed to.
Through the chair, Senator Tobin. No, very good point. I'm glad you brought it up. I was actually going to be on my risks, to be honest, but we'll go ahead and tackle that now because I know it is a hot button topic in Anchorage right now. So you do have a small number of folks. We have community council resolutions from the community council adjacent to this project that are in support of the project, but you are correct. We also have a resolution from the Rabbit Creek Community Council, a community council that is not adjacent to the project, that does not agree with that vehicular undercrossing at 92nd and Scooter. So you are correct in that regard. We have developed this project for the better part of 15 years. We've taken it through the NEPA process, which has resulted based in traffic modeling and the data in a preferred alternative that we have developed to a point of being ready to go to construction here. The folks that are frustrated about this, I think in general, are concerned about the impact of traffic moving from west to east, impacting the neighborhoods to the east of the Seward Highway where the Academy Vanguard intersections are located. And so we saw similar concerns when we did the undercrossing at 76th Avenue between Diamond and Dowling. That community on the west side was, or on the east side of that Seward Highway, was also similarly concerned about negative impacts to their community. That project was indeed built, and we actually, the concerns I don't think were bore out at the end of the day. The impacts to that side of it were not as much as it was feared by the community. We don't anticipate that there would be any of a different outcome with the undercrossing of 92nd. But more to the point, it has been due open a long time. It's been through the Planning and Zoning Commissions. It complies with all the Municipality of Anchorage studies that are inclusive of all modes of transportation. What they are seeking to do is to eliminate the vehicular mode of transportation from that undercrossing. They only want non-motorized transportation solutions under there. All of our transportation models indicate that there is goodness in having that east-west connection that will take pressure off the Diamond interchange area and also provide for all modes of transportation, not just non-motorized. And so when we've asked the question, is there, you know, give me something that I can go back to the Federal Highway Administration and say that the basis of our assumptions was incorrect insofar as the preferred alternative is no longer supportable. And that's where we have the stumbling block, where we don't have traffic data numbers that would suggest that our data was flawed and that the analysis was wrong that rendered the alternative that we are looking at. So, and that's where the risk comes in. If we go back to the federal highways and we say the community is asking us to completely restart this project to come up with a different outcome of a non-motorized east-west corridor under 92nd there, the federal highways will require that I come up with a rationalization about why I'm restarting a 15 years worth of effort, in some way, shape, or form, such as transportation traffic modeling numbers or purpose and need statements, such like that. And so that's the real concern and risk for the department. They've given us some data, but it's not data that we've been able to agree with in terms of the transportation traffic modeling numbers. So we're continuing to have those discussions. I know that the Anchorage Assembly has a draft resolution out, as you said, that is going to ask the governor and the commissioner to completely redo this project from the start after 15 years of project development. We're hoping that we can resolve those issues and those concerns. We feel like we've gone through a process that has been collaborative with the community after 15 years of public meetings, but only in the last few years have there been a few folks that have been very resistant to it. So I haven't read the entire resolution. I'm sure I'm quoted in it. Well, we'll see if those were taken out of context or not. But I do understand that there's concern there. Senator Tobin, does that kind of answer some of your questions?
Follow up, Senator Tobin.
It does. I'm curious, because you mentioned that is based off of NEPA and traffic data. Is there a possibility that you could get that information to our office? I understand the frustration. I myself am a bike commuter. I very much understand the want to put more multimodal and to reduce vehicular transportation because it does contribute to a degradation of environment. It does contribute to vehicular injury and such, but I also recognize that there is this push-pull, and trying to be responsive to community is something that I am trying to do well. So having that information will be helpful to me.
Absolutely. Through the Chair, Senator Tubman, we'll absolutely get that information to you. And thank you for bringing that up. That addresses risk number one, yeah, and also challenge number one. So
thank you. Please, with this and all other, please send it to my office so that we can get it through to the entire committee, just to keep everyone in the loop. I also had a question, or I guess some perspective. What's been shared with me is that the planning cycle is so long that, in the perspective of some, the needs change. In other words, where the planning duration, you mentioned 15 years, or maybe in some cases longer, so that over the course of time, let's say that other malls get built in other areas that starts to pull traffic away, other areas grow, and it changes the nature of demand, and that with that long planning cycle, that we could end up building a project that's no longer attuned to the actual needs. I hear what you're saying around the data, but I just wanted to share, you know, kind of the perspective that I'm hearing is that the long planning cycle can sometimes result in solving a problem whose time has passed, and that traffic is heading other places or no longer the problem that it was. I don't want to go into this, you know, chew on this too much here, but I just wanted to share that. Do you have any quick thoughts regarding present data availability relative to that concept?
Senator Kaufman, yes, Senator, we do back azimuth checks, I guess, for lack of a better term, to make sure that the data, the population projections that we use, the traffic modeling projections are still valid traffic modeling projections. We still make sure that we're tracking accident data and the causal factors behind that accident data, that make sure that the project is still aligned with current goals and objectives for the projects. So we in other words, it's not just we did this once 15 years ago and we don't make sure that the data is still relevant. It is in fact still relevant, but we will get all the information to you, Senator Kaufman, and if there are follow-up meetings or questions, please let us know. And if there's anything we can do to reach out more to the public and help inform them about how we come to these decisions, we would welcome that interaction.
Appreciate that. And there might be a conversation around what we can do to reduce the planning cycle. If this had been built 10 years ago, I wouldn't have to deal with it now.
That was correct. Sent through the chair. Yeah, whenever you're talking $100 million things, there is often very high levels of NEPA documents involved. So environmental assessments come into play. That can be a 5 to 6 year window. Some of the things we get concerned about is, you know, we've acquired property for this project, and in some cases under the authority of eminent domain or condemnation. And so for me to say, to tell a property owner that, you know, for the good of the public, I need to acquire your property for this capital improvement, and then to have that 5 years later, the community decide that now that we don't need that anymore after I've condemned their property, that becomes problematic in the Uniform Relocation Act sense of it. And so we want to make sure we have a consistent message, you know, throughout the development of the project.
I understand the challenge. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Can't quite see which slide you're on. There's a second Seward Highway slide that speaks to risks and challenges and opportunities and solutions. Do you have that up?
I believe so.
Okay. So some of the risks and challenges, one thing we're going to talk to is price. We don't know how the bid prices will be affected by inflation, and even a small percentage increase can be a lot of money on such a large project as this one. In 2022, we saw many of the bids for large capital improvement projects on the road system go approximately 10% over our engineer's estimate. This may happen in this case. Fuel prices are down a little bit more now, so that may be not as big a worry. Inflation seems to be coming under control to a certain extent, but that is certainly a risk that the project costs could go over to the current budgeted amounts. Road work on a major highway is always a challenge for the traveling public. And so our traffic control plans and keeping people moving in through the system is always a risk for us and a challenge. We already spoke to the draft resolution, so I won't belabor that anymore. Utilities are also something we don't control. We have quite a few utilities along the corridor. There was some delays with ACS, but I think we've gotten beyond that. So hopefully the project can move forward smoothly. Some opportunities, like on the Dowling Road under reconstruction, we will work with a contractor to minimize traffic impacts. The Dowling Road underpass bridge replacement this past summer was a good example of how travel impacts can significantly be mitigated by collaboration with the contractor. And of course, we will use all our social media tools and 511 notification systems at our fingertips to keep the public informed of all the temporary changes to the traffic patterns. So,
just a quick time check. We're on slide 17 of 34, so we've been asking lots of questions. Did you have a question?
One quick question,
Senator Tobin, quick one.
As I know that we are expecting some record tourism years, what is the plan to reduce the impact to that, the folks who are going in and out to Girdwood and to other locations, knowing that they'll be heavy utilizers of this space?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, we do require the contractors to submit traffic control plans that minimize delay and disruption to the traveling public. There are traffic control price adjustment penalties in place if delays incurred by the traveling public exceed too much. I think the 20-minute rule is in effect for this corridor. So we do have measures in place, but really we just try to collaborate as much as we can, up to and include building frontage roads and utilizing frontage roads for alternate routes during reconstruction of the main thoroughfare there. So we have a lot of tools at our disposal. I'm optimistic it'll be successful like Dowling Road was.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's proceed.
Next slide. Now that Senator Wilson's left, we'll go ahead and talk about the Matsu area. He and I are good friends. Okay. So we've got 12 total projects shown on this slide with an estimated construction value of $230 million. We're going to talk about Kinnick Goose Bay Phase 1 on a separate slide. So for now, there are two projects I just want to hit real quick. Seward Meridian Parkway Phase 2. This is a long-awaited second phase of the Seward Meridian Parkway upgrade. Phase one of the project was from the Parks Highway to Palmer Wasilla Highway, was completed in 2012. Phase two of the project continues that same theme of upgrading the Seward Meridian to a four-lane road with a multi-use separated pathway along the west side from Palmer Wasilla to Bogard, and extends Seward Meridian Parkway one more mile to Bogard Road, from Bogard Road rather, to Selden. Intersections improvements include roundabouts at Bogard, new signals at East Country Field near Cottonwood Creek Elementary, East Birchview Drive, East Tambert Drive, and Selden Road. A new bridge also replaces the existing culvert at Cottonwood Creek. Estimated project cost $60 million. Should have that bid out this spring. The second project I wanted to highlight, the Glen Highway Milepost 34 to 42 Phase 2, Parks Highway to South Inner Springer Loop. Phase 1 of the project was from Bogard to South Inner Springer Loop. It was completed in 2020. Right by the fairgrounds there. Phase two will complete the project from the Glen to South Inner Springer Loop, or rather from South Inner Springer Loop to the Parks Highway. Two lanes in each direction, just like the section adjacent to the fairgrounds, with widened shoulders, frontage road improvements, and separated pathway. Estimated cost, $70 million. And again, that should be bid out this spring for construction, summer of 2023. Any questions on this slide before we move on to Kinnick Goose Bay?
See any.
Okay. Well, moving on to slide 19, Kinnick Goose Bay Road reconstruction. This is phase one, Fairview Loop to Centaur. The project will improve safety and capacity of the segment of Kinnick Goose Bay Road by constructing a four-lane divided highway. The project includes constructing bike and pedestrian facilities, implementing appropriate safety engineering strategies, and access management strategies. Construction efforts began in summer 22 and are expected to continue through the summer of 2023 and 2024, with completion in 2024. DOT is working for the second phase of construction to follow on beginning of summer 25, which will extend the project from Fairview down to Settlers Bay. Estimated cost for phase one is $75 million. Any questions on this one?
I don't see any. Please proceed.
Okay. Slide 20 talks a little bit about risks and challenges for Kinnick Goose Bay. There was a little bit of right-of-way acquisition items remaining when we bid the project. We're down to one parcel remaining, and it's just an administrative issue with the title company, so we don't see any real, it's not an issue with the property owner, in other words. So that should be resolved fairly shortly. Also on this one, there's an unusually large amount of utilities adjacent to the corridor, including a 20-inch gas main from NSTAR. So all have facilities in conflict with the expansion of the roadway footprint. The conflict is essentially found throughout the entire length of the project, and the utility relocations are effectively driving the schedule. So the heavy lift here is the utility relocations. Those are the risks and challenges. Hopefully the utilities will track along, but we will work with them as needed to schedule the improvements and keep them moving. Opportunities, we are working double shifts day and night to limit the impacts on the public by only having traffic restrictions at nighttime. This is a very heavily traveled road, so we don't want to impact commuter traffic. This also allows for better production rates at night. Project phasing, also by splitting the project into two phases, we'll be able to limit the area of disruption and be able to complete portions of the project and turn them over to the public sooner. Any remaining questions on Kinnick Goose Bay?
No questions.
Okay. We're going to turn over real quick to the Kenai Peninsula 2023 construction slide. On this slide, you're going to see 12 total projects. Estimated construction value of $314 million for most of them. The remaining project, the Sterling Highway 45 to 60 Cooper Landing Bypass, is estimated now at around $690 million. We'll talk about the Cooper Landing Bypass on a following slide. The first project I want to note on slide 22 is the Sterling Safety Corridor Improvements. This project will improve the safety of the Sterling Highway between Sterling and Soldotna by widening the existing road from two lanes to four lanes. The project scope also includes bike and pedestrian facilities, access management, turn lanes, frontage roads, intersection realignments, and thanks to Senator Machicki, full continuous light. So that was a good assist on his part. The project is expected to advertise as a design build contract this spring. Final design, public outreach, field work, et cetera, will be completed with the selected design build teams. This is unusual because I think we've got a little bit of a public concern right now. They're seeing us bid a project. They think the bulldozers are hitting the ground in a couple months here. When in the design build type of a project delivery mechanism, we literally pair up a designer and a contractor, and they design the thing out for the next year with a lot of public involvement that we would normally do in a normal project delivery model. We're not going to see any dirt or bulldozers hit the ground for another year and a half, but people are kind of used to the old way that we do things, and they're thinking when they see DOT bid a project that dirt's going to turn right away. So we're trying to reconnect primarily through Senator Bjorkman, who took over for Senator Machicki, and working with the constituents there in the Kenai Peninsula Borough to make sure all of the concerns are addressed. Okay, next project, Sterling Highway Mile Post 157 to 169 reconstruction, Anchor Point to Baycrest. This will reconstruct and upgrade 12 miles of the Sterling Highway from Anchor Point to Baycrest Hill. Upgrades include widening, passing lanes, resurfacing, scenic turnouts, drainage improvements, and some minor realignment. And will also rehabilitate the North Fork Anchor River Bridge and Anchor River Bridges. Total project cost around $120 million. Any question on this slide?
Thank you.
Okay. Last slide that I have is the Cooper Landing Bypass at Sterling Highway, mile 45 to 60. This project will construct 10 miles of new roadway north of Cooper Landing in the Kenai River. Project will also provide widened shoulders, bring roadway curves into compliance with design speeds, add passing lanes, pathways, and wildlife undercrossings and overcrossings. A new Resurrection Pass trailhead and parking lot will also be constructed with trail connections to the Resurrection Pass and Bean Creek trails, as well as Juneau Creek Falls Overlook. Project's on track. We've got a strong partnership with our state and federal partners, Native corporations, Native tribes, as well as community and public. The construction manager general contractor type of delivery of this project has us paired with Quality Asphalt and Dow Engineers and HDR, to name just a few. The project began in 2021 and is scheduled to be complete in 2027. Estimated project cost, $690 million. Phase 1A, which is the Soldotna end, is construction is on the west end, creating Alaska's first wildlife overcrossing and bringing the highway up to modern design standards. The anchorage end that's on the existing alignment, Phase 1B, will be scheduled to be completed in 2026. If you'll move to the next slide on the risks, challenges, and opportunities and solutions, some of the risks, really the long timeline relative to the delivery of the project is probably our biggest risk, and that really has to do with inflation and price escalation. The short construction seasons and the huge amount of material to move for this construction project to accomplish over a seven-year period also brings with us certain risks. So those are the risks and challenges, the opportunities. We're collaborating with the Kenai Peninsula Borough and local planning and development boards. We're providing access with the new alignment and working with the Kenai Peninsula on plans for their Quartz Creek area developments, including coordinating with them on frontage roads and access to the new Three Bears development in the area. Collaboration with other agencies such as U.S. Forest Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to address recreation trailhead access and impacts on wilderness and wildlife have always been a success for us in providing solutions for this large and complex project. Any questions on Cooper Landing Bypass that I can answer?
I don't see any.
Well, I thank you for your time. I'm going to hand this over to Regional Director Kemp, I believe.
I just wanted to say thanks for dealing with the questions, and we appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you, and have a great day.
So please approach. Put yourself on the record.
Good afternoon, Committee Chair Lance Merrick, South Coast Region Director.
Welcome.
So I have three slides of projects around the region. I won't go into much detail here. This first slide is an overview of projects, and then I have two detailed slides for Juneau and Ketchikan. And we have projects mostly in Southeast Alaska, but a few out west, and I'll be highlighting later in the presentation, as did Wolfgang, project in Haines and one in Kodiak. Oh, I'm sorry. Were there any questions on that previous slide?
No, sir.
Okay.
Please proceed.
So these are our Juneau projects. And the first project is a trail project that we'll be starting this summer. The next is a resurface project that we'll just be doing punch list items on. It was mostly completed last year. The Egan Yandukan project is a safety improvement project. It's to improve, intended to reduce crashes at mostly left turns to Fred Meyer, but also to the airport. The next project is another Glacier Highway project is nearing completion, has been under construction for a couple years already. We have some emergency repair projects from the storm back in, I think, 2020, December. And so we have one going on on North Douglas Highway. And then on South Douglas, we have a major project starting reconstruction. That project's been awarded, should see construction activity out there this spring. And also the last one, a resurfacing project downtown from town to Mount Robert Street, should see that. That's just a resurface in spring, summer this year.
We have a question. Senator Keel.
Thank you. Director Merritt, on the Egan Yandukan improvements, I know there were a number of recommendations out of a big collaborative process. This, as I understand it, is the short-term changes within just the Egan Drive corridor itself. This, if I remember correctly, we're not talking about the more comprehensive fix that would connect Glacier Highway to McNugget and other changes?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, you're correct. That this is the first. There was a kind of a phased implementation recommendation. Do this, see how it works. Consider something if we still are looking to further improve safety. So this has a seasonal speed zone change to a slower speed in the winter, and provides some additional separation between left turn lanes for easier visibility.
Chairman, I look forward to working with the director on the rest of the project, which I think will be needed.
Thank you. Let's proceed.
We have several projects going on in Ketchikan. The Wolf Point slope stability is a area where there's been some rockfall. We'll be addressing that hopefully this summer into the fall. The next three projects are earmarked money that was used for the bridge that I really wish we'd built to the airport, but these projects are to help improve connections between town and the airport. Those projects have been under construction for a couple of years and will continue for probably two more. Then we have a series of projects on Tongass Avenue, and I could go into detail if there's interest.
We only have 10 minutes remaining, so
I'm screaming through.
Proceed accordingly.
Very well. So I'll highlight a couple projects. Haines Highway, an important corridor for our region. It connects to the Continental Road System. And so we've been working on this project for quite a few years, but our current project, three phases to upgrade Mile Point 3.5, which is about the airport, to 25, which is the Chilkat River Bridge. And phase one is completed. Phase two is under construction right now. Phase three is headed for construction in 2024. The total project cost is about $120 million, and we have $40 to $50 million remaining in the phase three project. We're straightening curves, widening shoulders, improving sight distance. We've raised grades to reduce shore protection along the river. And then there's a debris flow. There's a mountain that just continues to crumble across our highway, and we put in these big structures that you can see in this photo to help our maintenance crews manage that debris that we'll have with us forever.
Thank you. We have a question from Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Director Merrick, you chose this photo and mentioned these great big culverts. And I guess a question, I don't know who would like to take it, if it's you or Ms. Doherty, but my understanding is that those culverts are less than 20 foot wide, so the design didn't go to bridge, but that those culverts are, at least some of them, are not withstanding the loads, or maybe I shouldn't describe a reason, but those culverts have concrete popping off and they've got bracing in them and they're in trouble. Okay. Not necessarily digging into these specific culverts, but just in terms of how DOT works on these projects, what can you talk to us a little bit about how to prevent that sort of issue with future projects?
Through the chair, Senator Keel, that's a huge thing that we're dealing with right now. I don't know if I can condense it quickly, but we're not trying to trick anybody with making these smaller than bridges. As Ms. Doherty explained, bridges carry with them those obligations for inspections and things like that. So if we can get by with smaller structures, we do. So it's not like we were trying to exclude bridge people from the project, but as it turns out, they were not involved. And there were some problems identified in the design, and we've been working through that and continue to work through that and have some fixes in place and more that we're doing. There's some settlement and some things that we can't really explain or attribute to the design, so we're trying to figure out what we've been monitoring that over the winter. and continue to work on solutions.
But maybe we'll have a future discussion on the failure mode, the design of those. But this note, we have a little more than 5 minutes, and we still have one speaker at least to close out today.
I'm happy to turn it over to Joe if you'd like.
No, well, let's go ahead and roll for a couple.
Okay.
Two more minutes, and then we'll shift gears.
All right. Thank you. So some of the challenges I already talked about, and we're working with the community. There's tourism that happens. This having the road partially closed or traffic slowed down affects the ability of tour operators to move. We uncovered some human remains that we weren't expecting, and so that slowed the project down for a while we addressed that with tribes and resource agencies. And so far, everything's been handled appropriately and to the satisfaction of everybody involved, and construction continues. The next project that I wanted to talk quickly about is a project at the Kodiak Airport. This is a project that we bid in 2019, and we're awaiting funding, and the project came in a little over our estimates. And then PFAS was discovered at the airport. Kodiak Airport is an airport that was a former military base, Navy. Coast Guard owns it now. We lease from the Coast Guard, and so it got complicated. We couldn't figure it out. We shelved the project while we worked on these PFAS conditions, so we ended up doing some pre-testing of fence post hole locations so that we'd know where and when we would encounter PFAS and then how we would deal with that. We've got that worked out and are moving ahead with the project with the rebid here and hope to have construction going on next year.
Thank you. Well, thank you for your testimony today.
You're welcome.
For the record, Catherine Keith. We have Northern Region Director Joseph Camp online.
Yeah, thank you for having me. For the record, I'm Joe Kemp, Northern Region Director for DOT. Sorry, there's a little feedback there. I'll make this quick so we can get out of here. As you can see on the slide here, we have 49 projects coming up this summer, totaling about $310 million worth of work. You know, and just about all of them are federally funded projects, minus a part of one or two. So 24 different communities. I will add that we normally average about $180 to $200 million a year in contractor payments. And so you can see that we are doing a lot more work. The last couple of years, that last year was our banner year at about $240 million. Now we're going to be, you know, beating that pretty handily here at $310 is our estimates. We'll see where that comes in when we're all done. But so a lot of carryover projects. We are finishing up the last phase of University Avenue, which has been going on for quite a while, and that project will come in the last small section there close to Fred Meyer. We'll get done, and we'll have that whole corridor done. It looks really nice. So GARS is another one there that we'll finish up this summer. It's an interesting new intersection that I get mixed reviews on from folks, but it's attribute it to being kind of like a roundabout where people don't know how to use it yet, and then they'll start using it, and they won't know how to live without it. So it's it will definitely be an interesting project. So a lot of projects out west, you can see too. We're spending probably $150 million out of the $310 million this year on projects out in rural Alaska in the western district of our region. So, you know, we're hitting those rural communities pretty hard.
Director Kemp, we have a question.
Mr. Kemp, if you could please send through the chair, I'd love to know what the analysis is after Typhoon Merbrook and what DOT assets or additional resources might be needed to replace, fix, bring community back to whole.
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Coven, I think that might be a whole nother presentation to you. I think if you want to, DC Keith there might have a whole nother thing for you here. We are working on that. There's a lot going on there. It does not have anything to do with any of the projects that I'm speaking to here. These projects have been in design for, you know, year or years, you know, and so this those permanent repairs out there are a whole nother thing that we're working on that are not included here.
We'll look into that for a future presentation. So proceed with the short amount of time left.
Yeah, you got it. Okay, so last summer we did have another ER project on Richardson Highway. I'm sure everyone heard about that was Bear Creek washout. Luckily for us, we were already designing this project for a bridge replacement, and we're in the final stages of that when the washout came. And you know, we had 20 other locations on here. The majority of them were road embankment washouts and things like that, where we didn't have a major bridge structure or anything like that that was getting damaged from the water. So the benefit to this is we did get to free up some federal funds on this project, and we didn't have to use our traditional FHWA money. We got to use the permanent repair money that they allocate to us when we have a damage like this. So definitely we'll be good to get this thing fixed. It is repaired now to the point where traffic can cross it safely, but we will be doing a new project on it this summer. Okay. One other project here is the Cotsview Cape Blossom. I will talk to, you know, the Deputy Commissioner Keith did talk to regional planning organizations. They are working on getting their RPO for the Northwest Arctic Borough up and running. We have taken a different approach with this project quite a bit, especially on phase two, which is the Sadie Creek, which is approximately halfway from Kotzebue to Cape Blossom, where the port is. And the second phase, we've really tried to engage with the stakeholders in the area on a consistent basis, monthly. We're currently monthly right now, meeting with the construction and design staff, making sure that concerns are being addressed and that the community understands and stakeholders understand, you know, how the project's going to progress and what we need to do there. They're also trying to follow up with how the port's going to play out at the end. So that's been a big thing with the RPOs, and hopefully they'll sign theirs at the end of the month, and we'll have three RPOs in the region, so that'll be good, the coordination with everyone. So, and that was, it took 5 minutes. I was hoping to take four. Sorry about that.
Looks like we're doing pretty good. And any other closing or final comments? We're just a touch over, but just in closing. All right. Well, then I'll say that I just want to say thank you to everyone at DOT that testified today and those who helped prepare the information that we saw. It's a lot of work. And looking at these projects, incredible challenges that you're taking on every day, and we appreciate it. So with no further questions or comments, and again, thank you to the LIO support staff for helping us get the Teams meeting actually working and with no hitches. That was awesome. I appreciate it. Our next meeting will not be this week. It will be Tuesday, February 28th at 1:30. So there will be no additional transportation meeting. And this meeting is now adjourned at 3:02 p.m.